have traveled far, my little Kalel. But we will never leave you, even in the face of our death. The richness of our lives shall be yours. All that I have, all that I've learned, everything I feel, all this and more, I bequeath you, my son. You will carry me inside you all the days of your life. You will make my strength your own. See my life.
You will believe a podcast likes things deep fried. Welcome, Junkions, to another soaring episode of Junk Food Cinema, brought to you by FilmScoreRejects.com. Leaping over buildings and speeding bullets and et cetera, et cetera. I'm your host, Brian Salisbury, and I'm joined, as per usual, by my friend and co-host. He's a novelist, he's a screenwriter, he is the lieutenant of Megaforce and the greatest criminal mind in this room, Mr. C. Robert Cargill.
Dedicated to truth, justice, and all the rest of it.
Truth, justice, and the American platter at Denny's, because it's delicious. I mean, let's be real with ourselves.
American Grand Slam.
Oh, yes. No, we're not talking about, I mean, we are Junk Food Cinema. We will talk about food because
At some point
it will happen. But I am excited because we are finishing up Summer of 78 today. We are finishing up with the movie that, had we not covered, despite the fact that it absolutely was not released in the summer, we still probably would have been crucified.
Yeah, I mean, it is one of the most important, you know, nerd films of the, not only 78, but the era. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it was not in the summer, so we did not lead off with it, but we were like, you know what? We've cheated every other summer. You know, every other summer we've been like, well, this isn't a summer film, but we would be remiss if we didn't talk about it.
I mean, we did talk about Action Jackson in Summer of 88, which was a February release, because it's fucking Action Jackson.
It's fucking Action Jackson. Yeah, so of course we're talking about Superman.
My friends, I'm not given to wild, unsupported statements. And I tell you that we must evacuate this planet immediately.
Jor-El, be reasonable.
Once there was a civilization, much like ours, but with a greater intelligence, greater powers, and a greater capacity for good. In one tragic moment, that world was destroyed. But there was one survivor.
Now, wouldn't that beat all get out?
Because of the wisdom and compassion of Jor-El, because he knew the human race had the capacity for goodness, he sent us his only son. His name is Kal-El. He will call himself Clark Kent. But the world will know him as Superman. This year, Superman brings you the gift of flight. Superman, the movie.
And Superman is such an interesting piece of film geek history.
It really is. And to this day, I think it's interesting the arguments that you will get into between the people who love and revere this movie and the people who look back on it as, I don't know, there seems to be a weird negativity sometimes against this movie, which I find baffling, personally.
Well, except that there was a negativity to begin with about this movie. This movie is structurally weird. It is a movie that shattered canon, but it is also a movie that was heralded as the best superhero film for 30 years, at which point it then became debatable. And now in cinema history, it's referred to as one of the greatest, but it's very rare that you find anybody that thinks that Richard Donner's Superman the movie is the best superhero movie ever made. But for 30 years, there was no argument at all because nothing touched it.
Yeah, and like, this shattered Superman canon, not unlike the way Superman 4 would later shatter canon films.
Yes.
As it turns out. But yeah, you're absolutely right. And I realize that much like Superman, I need to fly around this podcast backwards a few times because I completely forgot to do the housekeeping stuff. So let me go ahead and do that. If you would like to follow us on Twitter, we're at Junk Food Cinema. You can also like us on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. You can buy swag at our swag shop on TeePublic, which is just TeePublic.com/user/junkfoodcinema. And yeah, we have a lot of crazy shit out there. If you want a new phone case or a tote bag or a pillow or a t-shirt with Stargrove's face on it, you can get all of that there. And also, if you really like the show...
I mean, really like the show.
If you like the show more than I still like Richard Donner's Superman, because come the fuck on already.
If you like the show so much, you would like extra episodes and more content and live streams.
You can go to patreon.com/junkfoodcinema for as little as a dollar an episode. You get access to all that stuff. And at the $5 level and above, you get access to a bonus episode every month called The Deep Dish.
The Deep Dish.
So there's a lot of exciting content out there for you. Okay, now we're going to go the other way and get back to where we were. I found it interesting that, you know, people have started to kind of look back on this movie with not as much fondness and the breaking of canon. I think that's actually where I'm the oddball, because I think it's its diversions from canon that make me like this movie so much, because Superman, by and large, is not a character I particularly like.
Whoa!
I'm sorry.
Get out of my house!
I'm sorry, I don't like him.
This podcast is over. Good night, everybody.
No. And I don't like him for the same reasons that Richard Donner has admitted that he had issues with Superman. To me, he's the kid that you grew up with who would always make his own rules whenever you played a game. You would come up with a game with rules, right? And you'd be like, if I touch you, you're frozen. You have to stay. No, I'm not frozen because I have this power. Okay, cool. Well, I dropped a rock on you then. No, I have this power. Would just keep fucking inventing powers to get himself out of whatever you tried to throw at him. And it was fucking boring to play with that kid. That, to me, has been Superman for most of my life. He's got so many fucking powers, and so many powers that he'll just come up with new ones in any given situation, that it's boring for me to watch him. And I don't particularly care for him. I don't see a struggle. I don't find him interesting. There's never a lot of tension. But there is something about this Superman, and there is something about Christopher Reeve's performance and his unflappable wholesomeness that, as Superman started to get more smug and pessimistic throughout cinema over the next few years, I found myself running back to the original Superman, running back to Christopher Reeve over and over again, because that was the Superman that I actually cared about.
Okay, so I've talked about this in a couple of different places. I don't know if I've ever talked about it on Junk Food Cinema before, but I have a general problem with DC heroes, with the DC universe. And my problem, since I was a kid, I've had this. Because, you know, I, as I've said multiple times, I'm a Marvel kid through and through.
Well, then why were you going to throw me out of your house for not liking Superman?
Because I'm going to get there.
Okay.
I'm going to get there. Because, you know, I loved what, when I was reading comics heavily in the 80s and 90s, what Marvel was doing versus what DC was doing. The biggest problem with the DC universe is that so many of their characters were invented, you know, so many of the great characters were invented very early in comic history. And they were invented by a different group of people. And what was great about Stan Lee and Jack Kirby was Stan Lee and Jack Kirby created characters that were conceptually built out of human flaws. Like, they would start with a very basic human flaw and create a superhero around it. That was the core idea. The Hulk was not, hey, wouldn't it be cool if there's this big, green, strong guy? Well, let's add a character to that. It was, let's tell the story of Frankenstein's monster, where Frankenstein is both the scientist and the monster. Let's do Jekyll and Hyde.
Yeah.
But it was the, you know, the genius of this and the guy who's tortured by what he's created. And then, you know, the rage and have the character be about this rage and this lashing out, something that we as people can identify with. The DC universe was created around a bunch of essentially Greek gods, and they are the Greek gods. But the problem is that they also suffer from the fact that almost every single major DC hero is not defined by their human flaws. They are defined by their relationship with their parents. That, oh, I'm an orphan. Oh, well, I'm an orphan from another planet. Well, I was kicked off the island by my mother. Well, my dad was a supervillain. Like, this is the core definition of almost every great DC hero.
But what was your mother's name?
Why'd you say that name? You knew we weren't going to get out of this without doing that joke, people. Please. There's going to be more Batman versus Superman jokes coming. Well, so for those of you Snyder Cut guys, it's going to be a bit of a bumpy ride. But I
think that is so illustrative of your point, is that the fact that they're not only both orphans, they're not only telling the same story, they can't even be creative enough to come up with different names for the mothers. Like,
so the two characters that I think truly defy that because of this movie and because of Frank Miller. Frank Miller's Dark Knight redefined Batman and recontextualized him. This movie recontextualized Superman for a new generation. What is interesting about Superman, why I love Superman, why I think Superman is still one of the greatest comic characters ever made, is he is exactly the character you described. He's the kid who makes up his own rules. He's the most powerful man in the world who bears the responsibility of being the most powerful man in the world and doesn't like being the most powerful man in the world. He does not lord that over people, and with it comes this tremendous responsibility that despite being so powerful, he can't save everyone. And that is a burden, and that's what weighs upon his shoulders. And the fact that he is so beholden to this Boy Scout-like mentality that it prevents him from doing the things that he needs to do. It's so weird that Batman is the darker version of this character, and even Batman won't kill anybody. The very fact that Superman killed Zod in Superman in Man of Steel set off a huge war in the geek community, despite the fact that that was taken from the comics. Like, that was comic canon. That is something that happened. But our idea of Superman is that Superman wouldn't do that, and that Superman doing that should shatter who Superman is for Superman, because what we love about Superman is the fact that he is pure and that he only wants to save everyone. He wants the world to be a good place. He believes in the goodness of mankind and that we are worth saving. And so he doesn't just fuck off and go live in the sun for 10,000 years. He fights for us and he saves us, and he believes that it is his duty to not only save a falling helicopter out of the sky, but to save a cat from a tree for a little girl.
Yes.
And that is what's amazing about Superman, is he just wants to make the world a better place. And that's why I love him, and why really, that's not a Superman that came before this. A little piece of comic history, people. Raise your hand if you know why Lex Luthor is bald and why Lex Luthor hates Superman. Guess what? They're tied together, because the canon history of why Lex Luthor hates Superman is because when he was Superboy, Superboy was battling a supervillain, accidentally got knocked through a window, knocked over a bunch of chemicals which fell on Lex Luthor, making all of Lex Luthor's hair fall out, and Lex Luthor was then bald and wanted to destroy Superman as a result. That's what canon of this used to be. It's why there's this whole gag about Lex Luthor wearing wigs and then revealing himself as bald at the end. That was Richard Donner and team making fun of the actual stupid brain dead history of where Lex Luthor came from. Lex Luthor, one of the great villains in history, the original canon version of him sucked. And this movie shattered that, dividing comic fans, because some comic fans are like, this is not my Superman. And others are like, yeah, we know. That's why we kind of like
it. Can you imagine? Can you imagine being so up your own ass like that, that it's literally the only comic book movie you have, and you're already, that's not my suit. Like, you're already taking a stand against, like, it's 1978. They're not making comic book movies.
No, they used to make comic book serials.
Yes.
But they weren't making comic book movies.
And the serials didn't give a fuck what the character, like, if you've ever watched the Batman serials, that none of that is Batman. No, it's the wrong costume. It's the wrong car. It's the, nothing about that is Batman other than the word Batman. It's fucking ridiculous.
Yeah. Yeah. And so that's, this is what we had. And this is the first time, there had been some stuff, some TV stuff, Marvel was just in this era playing around with, because comics had become so huge. We have to, for a moment, lay out how comic books were at this point. I guess this is the part where we play the song.
Old Man Cargill, that old man Cargill.
You did not go to a comic book store to buy comic books. That was a thing you did if you were a hardcore nerd and you were looking for backstock. No, you went to the convenience store. You went to the Five and Dime. You went to Sears. You went anywhere where there would be a newsstand. They were selling all of the big comic books. These comic books sold so well, Doctor Strange was one of their low-selling books in the 70s, and it was selling 500,000 copies a month. Think about that's one of the low-selling books. That is, today, 500,000 copies, you're lucky if a huge crossover event comes close. Generally, the big sellers today sell 200,000 copies. And that's when it's a huge, groundbreaking, number one crossover event that everybody's got to buy. Generally, most of your mainstream books sell between 20 and 80,000 copies a month. In fact, when the last Batman movies were coming out, the Nolan Batman movies, people were talking about how we need to stick to really close to canon. And there were some of us going, yeah, but the month that a Batman movie comes out and they have a bump in sales, Batman sells 67,000 copies. Do we really need to worry about the canon of what's going on right now, or do we need to focus on the core of these characters? It's a real, real conversation to have. Everybody in that era had pretty much picked up a Superman comic at some point in time. You couldn't live your life without running into them. They were all over the place. You would go into your local candy shop and they would have a rack of comic books there to buy. They were just around the grocery store. I bought lots of X-Men comics from Circle K's and grocery stores growing up, because that's where you bought them, because you know what? They didn't keep them in the metal racks, so they didn't get they didn't get the crack marks on the top corner near the top staple where people would be fingering through them, because they would have them on actual bookshelves so they wouldn't be fucked up, so you could get mint or near mint copies of the latest issues.
Nice.
So this is what you need to understand, is this is how popular comic books were in the 70s. And we didn't have any movies yet. So they were just going, this is blown up. How can we capitalize on this trend? And so there were lots of different ways they capitalized on it. And that's why in the 70s in particular, there's all this really great Marvel branded stuff. 7-Eleven did a new Marvel branded cup every month, every week for a year. So there's these plastic, great plastic cups with all the different Marvel comics heroes of the 70s that collectors track down.
Do you have the Dazzler cup?
Dazzler wasn't invented at the time. Dazzler was late 70s. Oh, okay. X-Men 131, I think. No, 130, I think, is where she first showed up, which was after they had relaunched the X-Men. Because I think 129 is where Kitty Pryde shows up, and then 130 is Dazzler, or it's 130 and 131. That's where those characters first showed up. So they weren't didn't exist during this big boom. But I mean, the boom continued as X-Men then took over, as we've talked about in a previous episode, you know, took over and carried through for so long. And became the number one comic in the world, took it over from Superman. But up until that point, Superman was the number one comic. So the very idea of an argument over canon and the fact that there weren't any big superhero movies is a huge element of 1978, and then would trigger an attempt to make movies that would then subsequently fail. Because, as it turns out, at that time, Richard Donner was the only person who kind of had his head wrapped around presenting these superheroes to audiences.
So the Salkinds, who are a father and son producing team that we've talked about before, buy the rights to Superman in 1973 with the intention of, in the early 70s, making that movie. And the filmmakers they go to first are William Friedkin, who
had just done The Exorcist,
did not want to do it, and Sam Peckinpah. And Sam Peckinpah did want to do it, but was removed from consideration. And this is, if you need one story that tells you who Sam Peckinpah was, this is it. Was removed from consideration when, during a meeting with the Salkinds, he pulled out a gun. And was immediately...
That is the most Peckinpah thing I've ever heard in my life.
It's a true story. Apparently, that's how he was removed from consideration, as he pulled a gun on the Salkinds during a meeting. So, Richard Donner, who at this point is preparing to make The Omen 2, is offered $1 million to direct Superman and Superman 2. Because the idea was, we're going to make both movies at the same time. Now, I want you to think about this for a second. They have not made a feature superhero film from DC or from Marvel. They've done made-for-TV Marvel movies that have been garbage.
Yep.
Because I watched, as I remember in middle school, I watched a marathon on the Sci-Fi Channel of, like, Spider-Man from the 70s. It was a made-for-TV. It's all awful. All of it's bad.
Doctor Strange, as we've talked about.
Yeah.
Not good.
All of it is terrible. And the Salkinds are so convinced that this is where the money lies, that they shell out $1 million for a director, and they're going to make two movies in an untested genre at the same time, back to back. That, to me, in and of itself, is incredible.
And then, hey, let's get one of the biggest stars in the world for 3 days.
The way Marlon Brando came onto the picture is kind of one of those Hollywood lore things where people talk about the fact that he was paid a total of about $11 million for 2 days worth of work. The one thing they don't mention in telling that story is that Marlon Brando actually had several scenes shot for part two.
Yes.
That ended up getting cut. So, yes, Marlon Brando asked for the sky and they gave it to him, but he also did a lot more work than what ends up in those first two movies. And because Richard Donner had essentially shot 75% of part two, when a difference of opinion with the Salkinds led to him being fired and replaced by Richard Lester. Lester came in and cut a lot of stuff. He cut a lot of things that, some of it, it's interesting. Some of the scenes are actually in Christopher Reeve's screen test. Some of the scenes that were intended for part two are in Christopher Reeve's screen test. And when you see those scenes in part two, they're completely different. So it's very clear that when Lester was brought in, he gutted a lot of what Richard Donner had done, despite the fact that Richard Donner had done almost all of the legwork. But yeah, Marlon Brando at this point, it's kind of surprising that this movie got off the ground, because the shit that they ran into early on was insane. They were doing pre-production in Italy, and all of the pre-production revolved around trying to make the flight work, trying to make Superman flying realistic on screen.
Because that was the selling point of the movie. I mean, that was the entire fucking tagline.
Goddamn tagline. One of the greatest taglines of all time.
You'll believe a man can fly.
And because they sold it that way, they had to make audiences believe that a man could fly. And they spent $2 million trial and error in Italy to make that happen. And then when they decided that they were going to start shooting all of the Kryptonian stuff with Marlon Brando in Italy, they found out he's not allowed to shoot here because he is wanted for obscenity charges for being in The Last Tango in Paris.
which has one of the most despicable, depressing Me Too stories in history that came out shortly before the Me Too movement happened, so it didn't get wrapped up in that. But if you ever want to have your heart broken about how awful a human being Marlon Brando could be, of all the terrible stories they did, the story about Last Tango in Paris and what they put that actress through, kind of, there's a reason why Brando wasn't allowed. Brando was awful.
Yeah, he was a pretty terrible person. And I mean, you could also watch the documentary about the making of the Island of Dr. Moreau. Well,
I was going to mention that. But as bad as he is in that,
there's not sexual abuse.
Literally taking a stick of butter and shoving it in an actress's ass without asking permission, for fuck's sake. Nothing he did to Richard Stanley comes close to the stick of butter.
This is entirely true.
It is insane that was defended for 30 years. That those guys are dead now, and it took them dying before everybody would go, yeah, maybe they shouldn't have done that. That was bad. It's like, no, there's a reason he was wanted in Italy, and it was good reason.
Well, and then they found out that they couldn't shoot in Spain because, I believe I'm getting this correct, they couldn't shoot in Spain either because John Barry, the legendary production designer, worked on Star Wars, made this movie look the way it looks, and is part of the reason it's so iconic. Was a tax fugitive and couldn't work in Spain. So it's like, they're like, okay, does anyone else have anything they want to tell us so that we can fucking start making this movie?
Is there any country on the planet we can shoot in?
So that is, I mean, despite the fact, also, Charlton Heston was apparently the first choice for Jor-El, which I think is kind of a cool idea. And Paul Newman was offered any of the three top roles he wanted, Superman, Lex Luthor, or Jor-El, and he wasn't interested in any of them and walked from all of it. But yeah, Marlon Brando was paid $3.7 million plus a percentage of the gross, and he ended up suing because he didn't think the Salkeens paid him for his percentage of the profit. So he ultimately received $14 million for 10 minutes of screen time, which in 1978, yes, is insane. But the footage shot for the sequel that Richard Lester ended up not using was used in Superman Returns in 2006, which I find very interesting. Also, I'm going to say this right now, and I don't, you can throw all the stones you want. I don't hate Superman Returns.
I like Superman Returns.
I like it a lot.
I'm glad to hear that because I actually would like to do an episode eventually on Superman Returns and why I like it. Like there's some interesting questionable things about Superman Returns and I get criticisms of it. But there's a lot to like about Superman Returns, a lot to love about Superman Returns. And, particularly the fact that Bryan Singer was just like, you know what? I'm going to pretend Superman 3 and 4 don't exist, and I'm going to make a sequel to Superman 2. And so that I'm going to sew this up where canonically you now can watch this story of Superman. And I think Routh is a fine Superman. I think he does a good job. I think Kevin Spacey was a good Lex Luthor.
That's going to be, I mean, it seems like every Superman movie we cover from now on is going to have some Me Too issues.
Yeah, maybe two doesn't.
I think one and two, and maybe that's why I still I think two might be the only one. You might be right.
I think we can get away with that. But I think it's a fine sequel that works within the framework. But there's, you know, in terms of worst Superman movies, worst movie with Superman in it, I would argue that Superman Returns is probably the third best Superman movie. Maybe you could argue that it's a fourth if you're going to put Man of Steel in there.
See, I would disagree with that.
But, we may have a strong disagreement on Man of Steel, because I actually like Man of Steel. Again, things I really like about it. But I think they get the Clark Kent stuff right in Man of Steel, where I like Clark Kent so much better than I do in any other Superman movie. But yeah, the Superman in that movie is it's no Christopher Reeve.
I mean, I'll give you this much. You like Superman a lot more than the director of Man of Steel likes Superman. So that's a feather in your cap.
That is, you know, I do. I fucking love superheroes and I love superhero movies. And you know what? And this is one of the reasons I wanted to cover this. Superman and Superman Returns both have scenes that bring tears to my eyes when they happen. And they're both almost the exact same fucking scene, but every time I watch that scene, I can't help but tear up the first time Superman shows up to be Superman in both those films. In Superman Returns, it's when he saves the airliner that's falling from the sky from falling on a baseball field. He lowers it into the baseball field. Like that moment, the first time we saw that, just it was a room full of geeks here in Austin, and we were all in tears and we were applauding, and the John Williams score comes up, and we're just like, oh my God, it's fucking Superman. Yeah, I'm an adult and I'm watching a real Superman movie. Oh my God. And the scene here when he first shows up as Superman to save Lois, and then the helicopter, and everybody's like freaking out, and it's like, fuck yeah, that's fucking Superman. It just works for me. And Man of Steel doesn't have that.
Yeah, and that's this is not what this episode's going to be, but just really quickly.
This episode is all about Superman the movie, and you can't talk about Superman the movie without talking about the legacy it created.
And that's my biggest problem with the Snyder Superman movies, is I need more moments. I need literal save the cat moments. I need more of those moments that show me that Superman is concerned about saving the little guy, and that's a big burden, is that he's constantly having to do that. I don't get that from the Snyder movies. Well, I really don't.
Snyder very much wants, he believed, because he's no longer, you know, making these movies. He believed that you needed to deconstruct the superheroes, that these superheroes have been done to death as superheroes, and now what we need is to deconstruct them and take them apart and put them back together again. And it's like, no, Superman and Batman are very simple. We watch Superman and Batman because we want to watch these characters brought to life and then have the great element of their character tested. That's what we want to see. We don't want to see them break that. We want to watch a Superman that wants to save every life on planet Earth, rather than creating a 9/11 like event and then killing the villain. We have plenty of superheroes that can do that. We have great superheroes that can do that. We have great superhero movies that can do that. That's not why we watch Superman. We watch Superman for the purity of Superman. We watch Superman because we want to see Superman float out of the sky after doing something amazing and see an 8-year-old boy or girl staring up in awe at their hero and wanting to be a better person as a result. That is why we watch Superman movies. And that is something that Snyder never got. And he knew that he didn't get it. He knew that he didn't want it. He did Watchmen, and Watchmen I believe that the final cut, and possibly, and I really like the director, you know, the ultimate cut of Watchmen, is a perfect superhero movie, and it's a perfect deconstruction, which is what Watchmen was. But there are times when I want Watchmen, and there are times that I want Superman, and those are not two great tastes that take straight together.
This is very true. But getting back to the Superman movie we are talking about, in a sort of proof that this is new territory, that it's virgin territory, who writes the first draft of the script of this movie? Mario Puzo, you know, the writer of The Godfather, not the writer of The Godfather novel, is the first person, and he turns in a 500-page script for Superman and Superman 2. That, in addition to having some but not very many of the elements that end up on screen, also has some really fucking hokey shit that, again, shows how the industry didn't really know what to do. Like,
well, and Puzo was never a great writer. Like, that, whenever people are like, the book's always better than the movie, and one of the first answers that film geeks will give you is, read The Godfather.
Yeah.
Because, like, no, it's The Godfather is a piece of shit. The movie is one of the greatest movies ever made.
Yeah. But, I mean, and this was before Donner came on, the script existed. So think about this. There's a scene where a bald Lex Luthor runs into Kojak in the subway station, and Kojak gives him a lollipop because they're both bald. Get it? What's hilarious about that is that Richard Donner made his bones doing a shit ton of 70s television, including Kojak, which is why the entire Kojak stunt team plays the robbers on the boat that get caught by Superman in this movie. So it's just funny that he wrote, but that's what the first draft was. It was some superhero stuff from the comics and a lot of silly shit. So another pass is done, and then when Donner comes on, he looks at even the second draft of the script and decides it's not really where he wants it to be yet. So he brings in Tom Mankiewicz, and Tom Mankiewicz, technically because of the way that the Writers Guild was set up, couldn't, even though he rewrote the entire script, could not be credited as a writer, which is why Tom Mankiewicz is credited as a story consultant on this movie, which was basically Donner putting his middle finger up to the WGA, because Mankiewicz is really responsible for almost everything in this movie as far as the script goes. And there's a great commentary on the Blu-ray between Mankiewicz and Donner, where they're just talking about all the different things that they came up with and getting this movie started. And of course, when you're doing a Superman movie, you're bringing Superman to the screen, it's vitally important that you select the right actor to play Superman. And they went through, I mean, it's a lot like the John McClane story, where they went through literally every big name working actor in Hollywood. They went to the Robert Redfords. They went to the Dustin Hoffmans. They went to, like, even fucking Clint Eastwood. Like, they went through the whole fucking Rolodex. And it was actually the casting director who had worked on movies like The Graduate and said, you know, there's this kid. He's done some soap operas. He's not a big name, but he's done some soap operas. I think he's really good. And even Donner was like, I don't think this Christopher Reeve guy is going to be right. We need a big name. And then when he came in to do a screen test, just knocked everybody on their ass.
Well, the thing about if you ever, ever need to understand and really wrap your head around how brilliant a performance Christopher Reeve is giving of Superman, and why it is so far and away better than any other performance, and any other performance there may ever be, there is a shot in this movie that you can find in GIF form online. But Superman is just flown off from Lois Lane's apartment balcony, because in 1978, a scrub reporter working the metro desk at the local paper can afford a penthouse with a balcony on it.
She looks like she's renting a room in Charles Xavier's School for Gifted Youngsters.
She looks like she's staying at the Ritz-Carlton.
Yeah.
Like, it is nuts. But so Superman's just flown off, and sure enough, there's a knock at her door, and it's Clark Kent. And she's like, oh, Clark. And she goes to go put on a sweater before she goes out. And he's standing there, and he thinks for a second. You know what he's thinking. You know, I'm going to tell Lois. I'm in love with this woman. I'm going to tell her. And he pulls off the glasses, and you see he grows 2 inches. Because whenever he's Clark Kent, he's hunching a little bit. And you don't notice that he's hunching. But he is hunching. And you have to be looking for it to see it. Because Clark Kent is shorter and meeker than Superman. And the minute he takes that off, just by taking off his glasses, you not only watch him transform into fucking Superman, you see why nobody else sees it. And they don't make any of the jokes about the glasses as the hiding the identity. Because in this version of Superman, it's not the glasses that hide the identity. It's his performance. And he is so good in that 1 3-second moment of transformation. It is just pure acting and everything that a great actor can do that meager actors couldn't even begin to do. And yes. And it's something that no one else who's played Superman has ever been able to do.
You're absolutely correct. And in fact, one of the reasons I think I love the movie Death Trap so much is that Christopher Reeve is doing that again. He's playing a nebbish Clark Kent character, but his alter ego is evil.
Have we done Death Trap
yet? We have not, but we need to.
Yeah, take a big old drink, because that is one of my favorite films that I thought we had already covered.
But do you see what I'm saying? Like, oh, yeah. He's definitely he's putting on airs and pretending
he's
to be
so,
meek.
He's so good at playing multiple characters in the same movie.
And then when he turns that on, when he takes those glasses off, instead of being like the superhero Boy Scout god, he's a fucking evil genius. Like, he's Lex Luthor. He goes from Clark Kent to Lex Luthor in Death Trap.
Yeah.
Like, that's my favorite part of that fucking movie. And I adore Christopher Reeve so much. Like, it might be part of the reason I've had such a hard time accepting any of the other actors who have played Superman. As much as I like Brandon Routh, I just, everything that I want Superman to be, everything I've always hoped that Superman would continue to be to break the mold for me of the Superman that I don't like, is epitomized in the way he plays both Clark Kent and Superman.
Yeah. Yeah. And nobody's done either better.
No.
I would argue that Henry Cavill plays almost as good as Superman. Like, when he's Superman, he's a really great Superman. I don't think he's a particularly good Clark Kent. I love the Clark Kent stuff. I love him as a teenager stuff. I love how they go with Nomad Clark Kent. I love that element. But I think he's as close as anyone's gotten in terms of that. But yeah, his performance as Clark Kent doesn't touch what what he does here. Like, this is, it's a masterful performance that in one shot you see two different characters, and it's so good.
And not only that, but I think this is so fascinating. One of the first people they approached to play, or they were thinking of to play Superman, was Muhammad Ali. Like in 1978, that, and the studio was on board with it. The studio was like, yeah, let's do that. Like, that kind of blows my mind a little bit.
That would have been, there would have been riots in the streets in 1978, but I don't know. 1978 is this weird, wonderful little like moment in history where America was pretty good for like 6 months. It's kind of like this, the moment that people joke about Republicans pining for, like in 4:30 in the afternoon in October in 1958. Like that's where everything was great. Like 1978 is this moment where the disco movement has happened. It seems like America is about to embrace homosexuality as a fine lifestyle choice that isn't, you know, to be mocked anymore. You know, everybody's kind of getting over the whole drug era and we're cleaning up government and everything's kind of good. And then it just kind of all goes to shit again. We get Morning in America, but we have the, you know, things start getting kind of really bad with terrorism. Things get bad with the Soviet Union. You know, things start taking a turn. And then, of course, America becomes very conservative again. But at that moment, I think maybe 78, Muhammad Ali as Superman could have been pulled off.
I do want to let you know that they filmed this movie in New York in August of 1977. There were already riots in the streets. Like, they literally were filming the night of the blackout. There's a great story, actually. They were filming the scene with the helicopter, and they were filming, you know, from the ground up to the helicopter. And the cinematographer, who, by the way, is a fucking legend in his own right, Jeffrey Unsworth, who did, 2001 A Space Odyssey, Murder on the Orient Express, A Bridge Too Far. Guys, and in fact, Richard Donner was exceedingly pissed off that his production designer, John Barry, and his cinematographer, Jeffrey Unsworth, did not get recognized by the Academy for their work in this movie, and that best production design that year actually went to a movie that just had to recreate a hotel that already existed, and it was a really ugly situation Donner was not happy about. But so the cinematographer's like, I need a little bit more light. We're almost there, and they're like, we're on the street. We don't have any more lights. We've got them all pointed up. And somebody said, you know what we do in this town sometimes is we steal a little bit of light from the city. So if you want, you can actually plug into the street light. So he goes to plug in, and as soon as he plugs into the street light, New York City blackout happens. And he was convinced for days afterwards that he had caused the 1977 New York City blackout filming this scene for Superman. So I found that story really fucking hilarious. I mean, we haven't even gotten to Gene Hackman yet as Lex Luthor.
Well, we haven't even talked about the core of the structure yet.
Oh, my God. Bizarre.
Well, first of all, I mean, it's very bizarre. Here's one of the other reasons this movie has been so divisive. It is told as an old school epic. It is structured like the epics of the 60s, where it's not told like a movie you could make today. Like, nobody would let me make this movie today in this way where, hey, by the way, the adult version of our character isn't going to show up for 50 minutes.
Dude, it's a fucking David Lean movie. Like, it's Lawrence of Kryptonia.
Yes, that is exactly, like, it is the Jackal. The Leopard. Like,
yes,
it is,
yes.
It is that epic told over time to where, hey, by the way, there's going to be several actors playing Superman before we fucking see Superman. And by the way, you do not see Superman until minute 50.
Yeah.
And you don't see Superman being Superman until minute 70. He shows up to the helicopter is the first time Superman appears to mankind to save someone. And that happens in his suit at minute 70. It is an hour and 10 minutes in a Superman movie before you see Superman being Superman. You see Clark Kent about 10 minutes before that stop a bullet cleverly, but that's not really Superman being Superman. It takes forever to get there. And it's a 2.5 hour movie. And oh yeah, by the way, Lex Luthor barely in this film. Like, yeah, we haven't talked about Gene Hackman yet because Gene Hackman is almost an afterthought in this movie. And in fact, most of the whole Lex Luthor stuff in this movie is the worst elements of it. Like, you could cut Lex Luthor from this movie and very few people would notice. This is everything to do with Clark Kent and everything to do with Superman becoming Superman is amazing. And it's amazingly told, and you get it. So when Superman makes his decisions to become Superman, to become the Superman he becomes, and also one of my favorite elements of this, there's something that redefined Superman at the time. This is not a part of original canon. Superman being torn between dueling father figures. The scientist who is very much against interfering with human history, and this the religious father who believes, even though he never utters the word, God has a purpose for you, son. He's like, I have to believe you're here for a reason. Pa Kent believes, Jonathan Kent believes that he was given this boy for a reason, and that he was supposed to raise him a certain way because this boy is going to do something amazing for this planet. He's going to be something really special because, even though he doesn't say it, God put him here. So Superman in this version is torn between the spiritual and the scientific. And he walks that line right up the middle through goodness. And that's what's so fascinating about this version of Superman. This was not a version of Superman before. Superman was a very, and as Fox News will point out, and I made a joke about at the very beginning of this podcast, with Superman Returns, where they literally remove the last bit of patriotism. The original Superman is an incredibly patriotic character, super patriotic, so much so that when Mark Miller did his brilliant send up of this, he made a great alternate universe version of Superman, a 3-issue series called Red Sun, where what if Superman landed instead of to Ma and Pa Kent in Kansas, he landed to Comrades Kent's in Russia 12 hours earlier. Mm-hmm. And that he ends up growing up as, you know, essentially
this is the Red Sun storyline.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. This is Red Sun, where he ends up becoming, the leader, essentially a hardcore communist. And it is such an interesting version of that story, but seeing the patriotism of Superman lensed through 50s communism is a fascinating deconstruction of Superman. And Mark Miller did such a great job with it. It's a brilliant, brilliant piece of history. In fact, I had a really interesting conversation online with Mark Miller and Jordan Vogt Roberts, because Jordan Vogt Roberts would love to, he pitched to Warner Brothers, hey, let me do an alternate universe Superman movie and do Red Sun. And they were like, no, because as people know Superman, he is truth, justice, and the American way. That is the one thing I think that what they did that was a misstep in Superman Returns is making the joke. He's for truth, justice, and all that other stuff.
Yeah.
And it's like, no, dude, that whole kind of point of the original version of Superman was he was the ultimate patriot. He was, you see him standing next to the flag. It's why when they were remaking it, a bunch of us wanted Michael Bay to do it, because nobody shoots standing next to slow motion flags like fucking Michael Bay. And it's like, you want to make the most jingoistic American fucking superhero movie ever, let Michael Bay make Superman. Of course, at the time, Michael Bay hadn't made the Transformers movies yet and would not go off into becoming the director he is now.
Well, and it turns out from the characters he has put into his movies, his politics seem to stray a little bit. Not so much as, like, there's definitely a divide, I think, in the politics of Superman and the politics of Michael Bay that never the twain shall meet.
But here, he's not un-American, and you can still see the patriotism in him.
Well, he says truth, justice, and the American way, and Margot Kidder responds with, you're going to fight every elected official in this country.
Yes, but this movie, the core of him is being torn between these two father figures, and it is a fascinating alteration to how he'd been dealt with before, and I absolutely love it.
Well, and the structure, I mean, the movie begins with an old-fashioned black and white movie house curtain being parted, and then we see a little boy reading an Action Comics about what the Daily Planet is, and then we are transported into one of the greatest title sequences of any movie of all time.
And the thing we really haven't mentioned that is the star of this movie, The score.
The John Williams score, which dun, 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 very close dun, dun, to being dun, a Jerry Goldsmith score, actually.
Jerry Goldsmith, fucking brilliant, did another brilliant, you know, we got Santus Dominus out of him.
Yes.
We have a whole meme for our show now. Santus
Superman
Dominus
Lex Luthor.
You know, Jerry Goldsmith did amazing, but
yeah.
John Williams, this score, when you hear that dun-dun-dun-dun-dun, you feel it in your fucking stomach and working up to your heart as your heart swells three fucking sizes, and it's like, oh my God, fucking Superman. That score, holy shit.
Which, by the way, I think is one of the smartest decisions Superman Returns made.
Oh, yeah.
Was to keep that fucking score.
Yeah, yeah. It's the, that is what Superman sounds like. That is the sound of Superman saving the day and soaring through the skies and giving us that camera look and that smile. Like, that is... music's so fun good. But yes, the opening title sequence
with those letters flying at you like it was supposed to be in 3D. By the way, how did, considering like how poor these movies got and how like kind of creatively bankrupt they got, how did we never get a Superman in 3D? How did they never even attempt to do that? Doesn't that seem like exactly the kind of thing that Superman 3 would have tried?
You would think, except that 3D came and went in 1983. Like, it really was, like, if for those of you that, we have not talked about it in a while, for those of you that don't listen to 80s All Over. You should be listening to 80s All Over. And 80s All Over just finished, wrapped up their coverage of 1983. They're literally going from beginning to end from the 80s. Every episode, new episode drops every 2 weeks. Every episode.
January 1984 just dropped this week.
Yeah, every episode covers a month in order of all the releases that came out in order. And so 1983 is just watching the glut of 3D films, none of them good.
This is very true.
And I feel like by the time they got around to Superman 3, it was not, they were like, we don't need 3D, we have Richard Pryor. So, and then there's not really much that we're going to say about Superman 3 because, like the Die Hard movies,
there
are only a handful of them. It's it's shocking how many super movies there are. Like you think, okay, we've got Superman 3 and Superman 4, and you got Supergirl in there, which is also a disastrous.
Wasn't there also a made for TV Superboy movie, or was that a show? I know there was either a Superboy made for TV movie or it was a backdoor pilot for an actual Superboy.
I think there may have been a Superboy. I do know that there was definitely Smallville.
Yeah, no.
Which Smallville was Superboy.
No, okay.
And then there was Lois and Clark.
Yeah, no, this would have been prior to Lois and Clark. I know there was some kind of Superboy property. I don't remember if it was but I will say this for Smallville. I think Michael Rosenbaum does a really great job with Lex Luthor. And I think Jonathan Glover as Lionel Luthor, I mean, those two characters are really the heart of that entire show. Like, the Superman in that show is so, who cares? He's so vanilla. But the relationship...
I like Tom Welling, though.
But he's just very vanilla. I don't dislike him, but there's nothing remarkable about him. But the relationship between Lionel and Lex Luthor on that show, I think, is great. And it's too bad that... Well, one, it's too bad that one of its stars turned out to be a complete fucking nut job. Like, you want to talk about child actors or young actors going bad? That's the queen of all child actors going bad.
You talking about Kristen Kruick?
No, I'm talking about Allison Mack. Allison Mack, who ended up being a recruiter for a sex cult.
Oh, yeah. And Kristen Kruick joined that cult for a period of time. So,
Jesus. Yeah. Poor,
yeah,
no.
She was recruited. But, yeah, no, that woman... Yeah, she played, was it?
She was a made up character named Chloe, who was like Clark's friend at the, she was basically the Lois Lane placeholder until they introduced Lois Lane.
Yeah, if you want to fall down a dark rabbit hole, look into that bizarre sex cult.
It's nuts.
Just Google Smallville sex cult.
That's all you got to do.
It is a sad, sad story of abuse and awfulness.
It's kind of a nightmare. And I think because the world is that way is why I still long for the unflappable nobility of the original two Superman movies, like and Christopher Reeve's Superman, because as we mentioned, the structure, so we go into this title sequence, and then we get to the planet of Krypton, where they are busy setting up the sequel.
Yes.
They don't even start this movie. They're busy. They introduce you to three characters who you won't see again until the next movie.
One of them, one of those, the great actors of all time, Terrence Stamp.
Yes.
Who will chew up the scenery in the best way in part two.
You will bow down before me, Jor-El, both you and one day your ass.
Oh my God, I love that so much. There's a reason that my son's...
That is every bit as good as kneel before Zod.
There's a reason my son's initials are Z-O-S, so that I could tell people to kneel before Zos. Like, don't think I didn't think about that.
Oh, Brian.
When he was first born, our buddy Grant actually photoshopped him for me, he looks like Terrence Stamp with the beard.
You're like, this is cool. And when he's 16 and does that to high school girls, you're all of a sudden going to regret it.
It turned out okay. I think he'll be fine. I think if we manage to get married, then there's hope for anyone. I think he'll be just fine. But yeah, they're busy setting up the sequel with Marlon Brando passing judgment on Zod and Ursa and I can't remember the Matuzak character's name. Yeah. And then sending them off in the Phantom Zone and then going... Okay, so this movie, shall we? All right, let's get started. Krypton's about to blow up. No,
it's not. It's not going to blow up. And okay. We all agree it's not going to blow up. You're the only one that thinks it's going to blow up. So stop being a reactionary.
And if you leave the planet, you'll be charged with treason. Okay, I won't leave the planet. Just real quickly. If he knows for sure the planet is going to blow up, and this bothered me about every iteration of Zod ever. If he knew the planet was
Jor-El,
going...
Jor-El, you mean?
I'm sorry, yeah, of Jor-El. If he knew the planet was going to blow up and was so sure, who gives a flying fuck if they were going to... If people who aren't going to exist in 2 days would charge you with treason? But he's like, no, okay, I'm as good as my word. We'll stay and die on the planet, but we're sending my son to Earth.
Yeah, because he does that... By the way, the writing of this movie is super clever. The screenplay is clever as fuck. The way they work in all of the elements and answer all of the questions about Superman's origins and Superman's powers is super clever constantly.
Yeah.
It is just a nice riff on making sure all of the elements are in there without ever making it feel forced. And yeah, this is the moment where he's like, all right, I promise you, my wife and I will not leave the planet. Didn't say anything about my son, no.
Oh, the monkey's paw. You should have been more specific.
Yeah, and so, yeah. So he launches his son into space. And then is one of the really cool things about this movie. His son is blasted at supposedly light speed.
Yeah.
I'm guessing. Don't know. It's got to be higher than light speed because he's actually from another galaxy. But however the propulsion works and however the magic of this sci-fi works, he ages like 3 years and is in there for thousands of years. Like yeah. His planet, like they even say that here.
Yeah. Brando says by the time you've reached your 18th year by Earth standards, I will have been dead for many thousands of your Earth years.
Yeah. And, also one of the neat things about the science fiction of this movie, not only that, I, as a kid growing up was always thought these were just all these things that he recorded. And then in looking at it, it's like, well, first of all, there's years of this shit. So no, he didn't sit down and record all this for his son. And then I realize in the way that it works, it's like, holy shit, Jor-El created an artificial intelligence of himself that is, this is what runs the Fortress of Solitude. It's an artificial intelligence. It's not just a bunch of recordings that interact to questions and such. It's actually Jor-El's artificial intelligence, and it's really kind of a cool, heartbreaking concept that's right there in this movie.
And there's a great moment that was not on the theatrical cut that's on the Blu-ray, where after Superman, because it launches into this, after he stops the helicopter from falling and saves Lois Lane, we get a small montage of him, you know, busting criminals and saving cats and trees and all this stuff. And then he immediately goes back to the Fortress of Solitude, and he has a conversation with Jor-El that, again, was cut out of the theatrical cut, where he talks about how he feels a little guilty about how good it all felt. And Jor-El's like, never feel guilty for how proud you are of helping these people. Like, it's this, like, he's having a bit of an identity crisis where he's like, is it prideful of me how much I loved how it felt to be adulated for doing all these things? And Jor-El's like, no, never feel. And that scene is exactly what you're talking about. He's having a conversation with his father.
Yeah. And it's fantastic.
Yeah.
So then we are now in the meat of a Superman movie. We are now, you know,
70 minutes in.
70 minutes in, we are now in a Superman movie. 50 minutes in, it starts, and that's the beginning of this. You could start at that Fortress of Solitude. You could actually start with the scene where he throws the thing, and you know what the story is.
Yeah.
And then go. And then you get a Superman movie for another hour.
Yeah.
And you get an hour of a great Superman
but
movie.
He is that through every... If you want to cut this movie up into chunks, every chunk of this movie, you know, we have the nobility of Jor-El, who won't leave the planet because he gave his word, even though he knows it's going to be destroyed, and wanting to save not only Superman, but the culture of his world. Then we get to Pa Kent and that Glenn Ford's portrayal of just like this sweet, noble, like salt of the earth. Like every single section of this movie is makes you so proud at the human, of the potential of humanity, that you start to see what Jor-El saw in us, because every single section of this movie has a character that you rally behind because of how noble they are, and the optimism and the hope that that instills in you only makes this movie more relevant and more beloved to me the older I get.
Yeah, and then I want to get to the last point we really need to hit, which is then an hour after that, Miss Tessmacher saves Superman from death so that Superman can go save the day, and then the movie's over. At that moment, there's no tension in the movie. The movie is, because of the choice they make, this movie falls apart right at that point. In fact, this is a movie very much that I've studied this sequence multiple times, because in working on Doctor Strange, this was we knew we were playing around with time travel. This was the sequence we knew we had to work around and make sure worked. Because when Lois Lane dies and Superman goes back in time, flies so fast, and how does this mechanic work? He reverses the orbit of the Earth, or he's going so fast that he's moving backwards in time. It's never quite sure, but the very fact that he can go back in time now makes Superman a very weird, broken character.
Yes. Now, on the commentary, Donner said something I found very interesting specifically about that, is that there's a lot of moments in this movie where, and we mentioned this earlier, where little bits of information that are going to be incredibly vital later are dropped in, not casual, but woven into other dialogue sequences. One of right. which being the meet cute between Lois and Superman on the roof when they're doing the interview, and she's asking him what color her underwear are. And it's just this cute little moment between them, and he takes a moment to answer, but he says he can't see through lead. Hugely important that that line is in there,
right?
For what happens later. It's not just another little like quip. The fact that they have Jor-El saying to him over and over again, "You are forbidden from interfering in human history.
Yes,
you are forbidden to do that." And the divide he feels, torn between the two father figures, wanting to please them both, wanting to live up to the potential that both of them saw for him. When he does that, it is breaking something that he absolutely felt like he had to abide by. And to me, because of that, gets around the idea of why wouldn't he just do that all the time? Why wouldn't he do it all the time? Because he knows he's forbidden from doing it.
Right. And that makes sense to me. And I love it. And that is absolutely woven in. And that's part of it. And yet the doing that, going back in time to save Lois Lane, doesn't feel, we don't get that emotional moment of that struggle. So we don't feel that beat there. That beat is not there of him struggling. She dies and he flies off into space to set time back. Like, it's like, there's not even a question. I'm going to fucking do it, because this is the only person that matters. Also a thing that I have a problem with Superman, which is, no, Superman is exactly the type of person who would sacrifice Lois to save a city of people. He loves Lois. Lois is his everything, but it's not about him. It's not about his feelings. It's about everyone else. That's what Superman is. Superman would rather suffer for the rest of his life having let the person he loves die than let, you know, than let more people die. And that's not what this Superman is. This Superman makes that, you know, this is where this gets Superman so right up until this point. And this is, again, why this has been so divisive a movie, that even though, you know, it was the best superhero movie for 30 years by default. Because, you know, in that 30-year period, the only real close contenders were Blade and Batman Begins. Like, those are the other best movies of that era. Everything else was just garbage. It was Steel. It was Spawn. It was Supergirl. It was
there's a movie
1989's Batman.
Okay, there it is. I was going to say, there's a movie that's suspiciously absent from this list of yours, and then you went and said it. Okay.
Which, again, was, you know, that was a huge disappointment when it came out. It's one of these things we keep arguing on Twitter with, you know, junkies who are like, but the first Batman is really great. And I'm like, I had to watch it four times as a huge Batman fan to find something I really liked about it. Like, I tried desperately to love that movie and could not because of, again, a lot of the stuff they got wrong, a lot of the weirdness, you know, a lot of problems that we now have come to discover are problems with the director of just the things that he focuses on, which is why so many people have been like, fuck that guy, fuck Tim Burton.
I hear what you're saying. I think where I diverge from this is I need my Superman, if nothing else. If every other superhero I'm going to watch on screen is going to delve into darkness and deal with the really shitty, terrible aspects of humanity that permeate our world, I at least need Superman to give me hope. That's all I... And if in the first fucking Superman movie, he lets Lois Lane die...
Well, no.
Then I'm fucked.
Like, I don't think that's the thing, is where this, I think what this movie really needed was a different, clever way for Superman to save Lois Lane in the last minute. Like, saving Lois Lane is just an integral part of the Superman story. No, he should not have let her die. I'm not saying that, okay. But the fact that he has to go back in time to do it, but doesn't go back in time and prevent all the damage throughout all the world from having happened, you know, doesn't go back so far that, like, there's that great episode of How This Should Have Ended, where all of a sudden Gene Hackman goes, these missiles have launched in a, and Superman just goes, hold on. And then he goes, these missiles right here. Cause I can fly so fast. I can go through time. I was able to catch both of them. I mean, you said, even I'm not fast enough, but clearly I am. Like, it really, that is a huge gaping hole in the end of that story. You know, and, I mean, I love how Lex Luthor trick Superman. I love that part. You know, I love Lex's, you know, the concept of Lex's plan. I still, to this day, will never understand why Lex Luthor can only be surrounded by complete buffoons. Like, that's just an element that...
Well, to me, that's the specific way in which Gene Hackman is playing this Lex Luthor is a total egomaniac. The only way he feels like the smartest guy in the room is to literally surround himself with dolts. Which speaks to the fragile nature of his actual genius, and also reminds me a lot of Twitter.
It seems very prescient.
Yeah,
like there is a. I feel that character is a satire of a character that, by the way, exists now.
Yeah,
but
absolutely.
That's not who Lex. That's not why we love Lex Luthor. Like, it's also why when people think of Lex Luthor now, people feel that the perfect version of Lex Luthor is President Luthor. Yeah. Like, that the best iteration of Luthor ever is the President Luthor era. And that is many people's Lex Luthor. Yeah. And I get that. And that makes sense to me. That came in when I was an adult. So for me, that's just one of the storylines that happened. But I do appreciate why people love President Luthor, because that's a really good foil for somebody obsessed with truth, justice, and the American way.
And I just think that Hackman, there's a vanity to Hackman's portrayal in that the reason he isn't bald until the end of the movie is because he refused to wear a bald cap or shave his head. And it's right. Like, and they still cast him. But the ending that you're talking about, and it may, I don't know if this changes anything or adds context to it, but the original ending of this was just Superman saving everyone and repairing the San Andreas fault, and that was it. Flying around the Earth was supposed to be the ending of Superman 2 to make Lois forget that Clark Kent was Superman.
Right.
He was going back in time to basically erase her memory. It's a giant neuralizer is what he's doing. So originally they had planned the flying around the Earth not to save Lois Lane, but to make her forget that he's Superman.
And that would have been a significantly better thing. Like that is the, and that's one of those things with Superman 2, the difference between the Lester cut and the Donner cut. I actually have a friend who's a professional editor who sent me his version. He edited together the best of the Lester cut and the Donner cut for his own version, which is significantly better than both of them. And in my head, my Superman 2 is the Frank Reynolds cut of that movie. And the tension of this movie just evaporates the second Tessmonger takes the kryptonite off him. Like and it's so great up until then, because how that all happens and Luthor's plan, and then Miss Tessmacher being like, but my mother lives in Hoboken, and the you have to promise me because you never lie, you have to promise you'll save her first,
right?
And then her kissing him, and then I'm saying, why did you kiss me? It's like, because I didn't think you'd let me after, and why can't I find a good guy?
Gender reverse that scene and tell me that's not a Me Too problem. Like, that is, like, I didn't think you'd let me do it after you were at full strength. I was like, oh, creepy. Thanks, Ms. Tessmonger.
You know what? No, it is, but it's also like you feel like she's a villain. Like, at that point, you know, the fact that she's doing that, of course she's stealing a kiss. Mm-hmm. Why can't I find a good guy? Because you're a bad guy. That's why. You just wanted to save your own mother. It's the only problem you have with this. Ms. Tessmacher is not a, she's a great character in this movie. In fact, I think she's the best villain in this movie because she's relatable and she makes a little sense. But there's, you know, her doing that is an adorably cute moment in a otherwise villainous life. And so I've always kind of adored her, I'm blanking on her name at the moment, but
Valerie Perrine,
who was showed up in a previous episode, which I think is going to be a future episode.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
She is in a little movie we love called Can't Stop the Music.
You can't stop the music.
Nobody can stop the music. Where her...
As evidenced by the fact that episode's coming back.
That episode is coming back. You can't stop it.
Can't stop it.
Apparently it never got uploaded properly to iTunes, so you guys have been asking for it, and we're like, dude, we did that ages ago. Fucking leave us alone. And it's like, oh, wait, no. It never got uploaded properly in a changeover.
So we're flying around the Earth backwards and putting that episode backwards.
That episode will be coming up where we will... You'll hear some vintage fucking... like, a vintage so old you had not met your wife yet.
This is true.
And we're still living in the steakhouse.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's going to be interesting
where
because...
we were recording... This is even before we were recording in your sex dungeon. This is when we were still recording in your ante room.
Yeah, that's true. So, yeah, to kind of give you guys a little heads up, next week, the episode... It's a very special lost episode of Junk Food Cinema that we did not realize was lost for so long, but it was never... Apparently, we made the move over to Blog Talk, and even before that, it didn't end up on iTunes. But the first half of our musical episode, Can't Stop the Musicals, disappeared for a long time. So I'm actually having Meryl do a completely new edit on it. So it's going to, even if you've heard it before, it's not going to sound the same. And we're releasing it next week as our main episode.
How's he going to edit in? We didn't have most of our memes at this point.
I don't know. It's going to be a challenge.
We hadn't done Stargrove yet. You know, we had not done Never Too Young to Die.
We may
Old
not
Man have, Cargill wasn't a thing.
Maybe like, not even Tango.
Cash.
Which, by the way, guess who the editor is on this movie? Stuart Baird.
Yep.
Who was brought in to save Tango.
Cash.
And Demolition Man.
Cash.
And a lot of movies in the 80s and 90s.
Yeah. And he does a good job here. Again, the only flaw I have with this movie, the only flaws are I don't really like the Lex Luthor, and I don't really like the traveling around the world time setback. It really does remove the tension from an otherwise masterful epic. Like, the rest of this movie became Superman canon. It changed Superman canon, and then it became Superman canon, and it redefined what a superhero movie could be in that it set up that, hey, as long as you get the soul of the character right, you can rejigger the facts, the canon. Mm-hmm. You can change it around, because if you walk out of that movie and go, that is my hero, you're just watching another story of that hero in a different medium, and that's fine. But this gets the soul of Superman absolutely correct all the way through, and it's why I love it.
And I mean, Ned Beatty in this as Otis is incredible. We do have an interesting story about the actor who plays Perry White, who was a last minute replacement because Jackie Cooper's his name. They had an actor in mind. It didn't work out. So at the last minute, they fly in Keenan Wynn, who's an actor we've talked about a lot. He was in Piranha. He's in a lot
Piranha.
Of Piranha. He's in a great deal of movies that I love. And he literally got to the airport and had a heart attack. Like, he was 61 years old, and he was rushed to the hospital, getting to the airport to take this role. And Donner calls up Jackie Cooper and said, I hope you have a passport, because I need you here Thursday. And Jackie Cooper puts the phone down, runs upstairs. Yeah, I have a passport. Wait, today's Thursday. Yeah, exactly. So Jackie Cooper, like, definitely does a great job in this. All of the talent behind it, like, it's incredible.
I will say, though, my favorite Perry White ever, Lawrence Fishburne.
Oh, yeah?
Like, yeah, my only problem with Fishburne's Perry White is in Batman versus Superman, where there's this one moment where Clark Kent's like, hey, I got this really great story on the Batman. And he's just like, nobody cares about the Batman. And I'm like, what kind of fucking
Bullshit.
What kind of newspaper guy doesn't want to fucking write a head, even a, not even a headline, but a story about this crazy guy who runs around cleaning up crime for the last 20 years? Like, of course people want to know about fucking Batman.
I'm going to quote Margot Kidder in this movie. Great reporters do not get great stories. Great reporters make great stories.
She's so good in this movie.
She's amazing.
She is just like, this is the role that defines Margot Kidder. It's also crazy how young she is in this movie.
Yeah.
Like, she's super young, and they don't make a meal out of it, but they do point out, and I love that they point this out, where Superman is a teenager and running to outrun the train so they can do the faster than a speeding locomotive gag. And Lois Lane is the only one that sees him. She's the first person to ever see Superman.
Yeah.
She's been daydreaming about this guy since she was a wee lass. She's clearly 10 years younger than Superman.
Yeah.
And they don't make a meal out of that she's like, she's this seasoned reporter on the Metro desk. She's what, 21 when she made this movie?
Yeah.
22?
And she beat out Stockard Channing by a hair to get this role. Apparently the two of them were like neck and neck. They weren't sure who they were going
to
go with.
Oh, poor Stockard Channing had to go off and be in Grease. That's other
isn't
big
that fucking
movie.
Crazy? She gets Grease, the most successful movie of 1978. Margot Kidder in the second most successful movie of 1978.
And Stockard Channing, of course, fucking legend.
Yes.
So, like, she would have been great. Stockard Channing would have been absolutely fantastic.
Nobody lost in this deal.
But, no, I think she's a better Rizzo than a Lois Lane.
Oh, yeah. I would agree with that. And it's just, it's heartbreaking. I think it was just this year that we lost Margot Kidder. And I just found out, I didn't know this, apparently it wasn't immediately reported, that it was a suicide. Like, I did not hear, I mean, like,
that's why when she died, there was all the, well, she was troubled. She was suffering from mental illness, and she wasn't getting the help she needed. And it's in fact something that we just dealt with. At this point, it's going to be a few weeks away, but something we just dealt with this past weekend, where somebody ran into an old actor who used to be on a TV show, on the Cosby Show,
yeah,
fucking 35 years ago. Someone ran into him working in
a Trader Joe's,
and that became a news story. And it's like, how is it a fucking, like, in fact, in this way, it was like, how is it a news story that someone who hasn't had an acting job in forever is working a day job? And it's like, oh, because he's black and we need some distracting, fun human interest story that will work on Fox News to distract from the fact that this weekend has been really, really, really bad for the friends of Fox News. So it was a really, really sad story, but it was one of those things that the only time you heard about Margot Kidder over the last decade or so was when she would do something really nuts.
Yeah.
And people would be like, oh, poor Margot Kidder, or hee hee hee, crazy actress. And it's like, no, this is really sad. And then, yeah, so...
I mean, but when you pair that with how what happened to Christopher Reeve, like, it's just, it's so tragic. And it's like, I guess that's the other reason that I run back to the first two Superman so much is, like, even for the people in the movie, even for the people that these movies revolve around, life got really shitty. Like, I need my Superman and my Lois Lane and my characters in this movie to represent something else. Like, to take me away from this.
Who would have thought the most stable, sane, successful member of this cast would ultimately turn out to be General Zod?
Yeah.
Like Gene Hackman, of course, you know, would go on, continue a great career and do very well.
But then retire from acting and just decided he didn't want to do it.
Well, yeah, he got really cranky at the end. Like, I've talked to people who worked with him in the late 90s. He just didn't want to be there.
Yeah.
Like on the set of The Replacements, he didn't even want to be in long shots. He had a stand in body replacement for all the long shots because he didn't want to be on set. He didn't want to have to work. He didn't want to be out there.
You will believe that this is Gene Hackman.
That's why the end of his career was like 10 years of doing Home Depot ads or Lowe's.
Yeah.
Because
he could sit in a room and
room and do the thing. And then he'd read the lines and then he'd go. He just got overworking. He got done with it. I don't think we're ever getting rid of Terrence Stamp. Terrence Stamp will be making movies till the day he dies.
And that's God why I
love Terrence Stamp.
And Zod love him for it. That's all I'm going to say.
Meryl already probably played that.
Probably. And that brings us to the junk food pairing, which this is something I remember from my childhood. And I think because of that.
Oh my God, are you going where I think you're going?
With the Superman ice cream?
Yes!
Yes.
Oh my God, I love that you picked that.
Oh yeah.
Because that's what I was like, to my childhood, I'm like, oh, I remember the Superman ice cream. That, yes.
Because again, even though this was released in December, the original Superman the movie always reminds me of summer, and it reminds me of being a kid and playing outside and putting on a cape and wanting to like save people and be, you know, superhuman, and ice cream and summer go together like summer and ice cream, for fuck's sake. And this ice cream had blue, red, and yellow, just like the swirls of what looked like sherbet. It was all mixed together, and you'd get it on a cone, and you would feel like king of the goddamn universe eating it. And
oh, I thought you were talking about the ice cream one that actually had the logo in it.
Also good. That was like, yeah, that was
like
almost
the bomb pop version.
Yes. Yeah. No, that was also good. Like pretty much any Superman connection to ice cream, you couldn't go wrong when we were kids. Like Superman knew ice cream somehow. But yeah, no, absolutely. Definitely what I'm going with. And I appreciate you guys soaring with us forwards or backwards through the summer of 78 and the summer of 88, as we have officially closed the book on another series that we've done here. And, yeah, it's been a blast, and you can find all of that on Blog Talk Radio or on iTunes. You can also follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema, like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. And if you really like the show...
I mean really like the show.
If you like the show more than I love Margot Kidder, you can go to patreon.com/junkfoodcinema for as little as a dollar an episode. You get access to content that nobody else gets to hear. Cargill, where can people find you on the interwebs?
You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Massawyrm, MassawyrM.
Awesome. You can find me on Twitter at BryGuySalisbury or just at junkfoodcinema, tweeting all the ding dong damn time. And we'll leave you knowing that you will believe that there are not one but two different kinds of Superman ice cream.